Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When Hurricane Helene pummeled the western portions of the Carolinas nearly 2 years ago, the devastation was immense. Homes were swept away, businesses destroyed, bridges and roads vanished in the floods. And much of the modern infrastructure we've come to depend on was knocked offline for a significant amount of time. Locals knew recovery would take time, but due to a change in administrations in Washington, a budget impasse in Raleigh, and other factors, that recovery has been slower than anticipated. In some cases, it stalled, delaying important decisions on what to rebuild and where to rebuild it. It slowed decision-making on how to prepare for the next storm and how to restore communities in ways that make them stronger than before Helene. So this hour, we dive into all of that and explore the concept of resilience. Resiliency, let's make it that word. We're at the UNC Charlotte Dubois Center in Uptown Charlotte as part of WFAE's Carolinas Climate Summit. And our guests this hour are Gerard Albert III, the Western North Carolina Rural Communities reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio, who has reported extensively on recovery efforts in the aftermath of Helene. He is here along with Benjamin Duncan, the Chief Resilience Officer for the state of South Carolina and the South Carolina Office of Resilience. And Chris Joyelle is Healthy Communities Director at Mountain True. That's a nonprofit working to protect forests, safeguard clean water, and support healthy, sustainable communities across Western North Carolina and the Southern Blue Ridge Mountains. Thank you all for being here. Welcome. So, Gerard, as a reporter, I'm going to start with you here because you've been covering this since I think you arrived in Asheville as a reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio about 20 minutes before Helene struck. And you've been reporting on how this area has been doing in its recovery efforts for a year and a half now. So what is the state of recovery right now as we speak?
It's a difficult question to ask. It really depends on a few things: how large of a scale you want to look at it at, what neighborhood you go to, and also, you know, what federal agency you want to point to and see what funding they've brought in. All that to say, it's varied. We were talking a little bit about the city of Asheville and its downtown, which is mostly unharmed during the storm, minus going about 60 days without running water. Infrastructure-wise, downtown, you wouldn't know a storm hit, but the city of Asheville's water supply was crushed, and there's a lot of money going towards that and a lot of repairs going on with that. When you get on some of the more rural communities, you start to see the destruction almost as it was the day after the storm. You've got chunks of road in the river still, massive amounts of debris in the river. People who can't live in their homes because the homes still have storm damage, and they're waiting on a myriad of nonprofit and federal and state agencies who are supposed to step in and help.
That was going to be my next question, and that is, this has been going on for a year and a half. We've heard about these legendary stories of FEMA and their delaying efforts, relief efforts, money getting to people, underfunding from Washington. The state of North Carolina has pumped $1.5 billion into recovery effort, and yet people are still waiting for that money. Why?
Another complicated answer, which, as I've delved into storm recovery, I've realized everything is complicated. The big thing right now on the federal level is that DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is not running. It's not funded. There's been an impasse about oversight for the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agency, and DHS is the agency that houses FEMA.
Right.
So a lot of FEMA funding has all but stalled. That FEMA funding is not so much at the individual level, which is what you see in the immediate aftermath of the storm. It's these massive tranches of money that local governments are waiting on to reimburse them for things they had to do after the storm multiple counties and small towns that spent more than their entire operating budget on clearing debris after the storm, still waiting on that money. It's impacting their budget talks, which are ongoing right now.
We've watched FEMA do their thing at beaches around the country and in Florida, where hurricanes are normal courses of events, Chris. But one thing that made this situation in the mountains different is that when it hits a beach or when it hits a flat area like Florida, you pretty much know where the damage is and who's been affected by it. But the nooks and crannies that mountain peaks and valleys and these little places that have one-lane private roads to get to the place where somebody lives, you don't even know that they're in trouble. Has that been part of the problem in getting relief efforts? Because you've been highly involved with your nonprofit in getting those efforts to these people. How difficult has that proven to be?
It's been a real challenge. Communities are already, a lot of the rural communities have very little capacity to deal with something of this scale. You know, we're working in some towns where they have a part-time mayor, a one-day-a-week mayor, mm-hmm. a volunteer council, and a town administrator wearing a dozen different hats. And those are the people that have to go out and be able to assess the damage. They have to be able to make the applications for funding. And it just puts incredible stress on what was already a pretty winnowed down government in a lot of these communities. We've seen communities with very few resources that have done incredible things, but there is just a lot more work that needs to be done. I can say, for example, in Avery County, going towards Boone, we had a community representatives that reached out to us and said that they had 800 private bridges that needed inspection. I had a team of maybe a dozen structural engineers that were willing to volunteer with us to do that work. That could be a decade's worth of work. So it's the scale of this is just immense.
Has your organization and others working on relief efforts been able to get to all the people? Do you even know that you've gotten to all the areas that need help?
Yeah, I don't think that we have. It's unfortunate, but you know, even as we scaled up, we went from an organization of about 25 people prior to the storm to now we're about 130, with the bulk of those new hires being debris team that is out there removing PVC pipes, couches, you name it, from the river and trying to clean up the tributaries to the French Broad and some of the main rivers coursing through western North Carolina. And there's only so much time in the day to be able to address all this. So we're doing our best, but we've got a long list of communities that have been waiting on us to get there.
Gerard, 5 months ago in December, you wrote about the physically taxing and emotionally draining cleanup work that continues in your part of the state. And you spoke to Donovan Green, who works for Mountain True. She told you that, quote, folks think because it's been a year, there must have been so much cleaning done, but in reality, that is not the case. So how much is left to do?
I want to give some context to the quote and some props to organizations like Mountain True, because a lot of cleaning has been done. There's just a lot more to do. The number of metric tons, if I even could remember it, wouldn't really register. It is so much. Just to kind of try and paint a picture of, you know, the river, if anyone has driven ever before near Chimney Rock, there are just boulders that are the size of like small school buses, tree trunks that are, you know, take three people to wrap their arms around, massive amounts of debris in rivers like that, not to mention other types of debris like PVC pipes and cars and campers and trailers out there. I mentioned Chimney Rock especially because the roads to get out there were almost impossible to get a large debris truck out there before the storm. And now that, you know, some of these roads are one lane in certain sections, some of them have only gravel on them. The main road from Batcave to Chimney Rock, which goes east to west, just reopened 2 weeks ago.
And he just alluded, Chris, to the immense amount of debris that has to be removed. I think your organization pulled 10,000 pounds of trash out of the waterways every day in western North Carolina. This follows the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers. They removed 4 billion cubic yards of debris. How much longer is it? Are you still removing 10,000 pounds of trash a day? I mean, how much longer will this go on? And what has been the damage to the environment?
Well, I believe the number might be 300 metric tons of debris that we've removed alone, not including what the Army Corps. The Army Corps is working around bridges and structures that are threatened, and removing the trucks and some of the equipment that we can't remove. But we're out there trying to get to the other 90% of the rivers that just aren't going to get any attention, and trying to be able to clean those up so that river rafting operations can begin again, fishing guides can get back out and do what they do. I think that we've got funding to run through the end of this year for this 100-plus team that's out there cleaning up debris, and we're lobbying in Raleigh in a couple weeks to see if we can extend that for another year. So I can say that I had someone who had experienced the recovery efforts in New Orleans, a planner who actually led that effort for the recovery plan out there. And right up front, he told me, you're up for about a decade's worth of work.
Wow.
And that really helped me understand. He's like, this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. You've got to pace yourself and just recognize that for many communities, it took over a year for them just to have the bandwidth to think about recovery.
So Benjamin Duncan has been sitting very quietly here, enduring this conversation, but that's okay because you're resilient.
Yes.
He is the chief he's the chief resilience officer for the state of South Carolina. And in most of our conversations over the last year and a half on this program about Helene, we've always concentrated on Western North Carolina. But Helene was the deadliest hurricane ever to hit South Carolina in the last century. You experienced 21 tornadoes, hurricane force winds, rain, flooding, 49 people died, 5,000 homes were destroyed. I don't think we know about this. Can you compare the damage to what you experienced to what we've been talking about?
Sure. In South Carolina, we've had 4 hurricanes in the last 9 years. We have a lot of practice in disaster recovery and resilience, and so we're working on that daily. Just a note here, for the 3 previous storms before Hurricane Helene, we had 70,000 people apply through FEMA. For Hurricane Helene, we had 443,000 people apply for assistance. So that shows you the magnitude of that disaster. And again, we've been practicing because of the number of hurricanes we've had since 2015. Prior to 2015, it was 1989, we had Hurricane Hugo. Nothing until 2015. So just look at that range where we were sitting at a lull, not being prepared for a disaster. Now we are being prepared on a daily basis.
I have to take a break in about 30 seconds, but you have an Office of Resilience, and it's been in existence for about 5 or 6 years now. So did that help you be prepared for what Helene brought you?
Yes, because we had a disaster in 2015, 2016, and 2018, we are now, we went from disaster recovery to the Office of Resilience. The governor and the legislature worked together to create the Office of Resilience.
Benjamin Duncan is the Chief Resilience Officer at the South Carolina Office of Resilience. He's here with Gerard Albert from Blue Ridge Public Radio and Chris Joyelle from Mountain True. We're going to take a break and come back with more from our climate summit here at the Dubois Center at UNC Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from the UNC Charlotte Dubois Center uptown for the WFAE's annual Carolina's Climate Summit. I knew I'd get it right if I thought about it for a second. We're here with Gerard Albert. He's a reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio, has been covering the disaster and recovery efforts in Western North Carolina. Chris Joyelle is the Healthy Communities Director for Mountain True, which has also been working diligently on that recovery. And Benjamin Duncan is the Chief Resilience Officer for the state of South Carolina and their Office of Resilience. Let's talk about that. You have an Office of Resilience. Why?
Well, as I said previously, we've had disasters in 2015, 2016, 2018, and 2024. But after having those series of hurricanes early on, the governor and legislature said, we don't need to be disaster recovery anymore. We need to be resilience. We need to be on the front end of those storms. So with disaster recovery, we were just repairing and replacing homes for low to moderate income individuals. And to date, we've repaired 3,462 homes for low to moderate income individuals. But after that 2018 hurricane, Governor McMaster says, no, we need an office of resilience. We don't need to be, just repairing these homes and being disaster recovery. So the Office of Resilience was created. And what we do with the Office of Resilience, again, we have the Home Repair and Replacement Program. We have Infrastructure Project Program, meaning stormwater drainage. We have home buyouts in repetitive flooding areas, in areas where homes are repetitively being flooded by hurricane or heavy storms. And we have the matching grants program for cities and counties that may get a grant from outside of the normal grant process where they don't get 100%. They may get 80 or 90%. We can come up with the funds or match those funds with a 10 or 20% match.
And where does all that money come from?
It comes from HUD. Some of this money comes from FEMA through the BRIC program. Some of this money comes in from the state dollars that are allocated for the programs.
FEMA has been slow in responding, at least in Western North Carolina. Have you found them to be equally slow in South Carolina?
FEMA was slow, but we asked for speed. We asked for speed.
Does that matter?
it did in a sense when the governor was calling the president and telling him we need help to get to South Carolina, and we did. FEMA came in, and they immediately gave us, within a few months, a disaster case management program. It was $22 million. We've hired about 100 people to go out in those areas you talked about earlier to find those folk that were harmed through a disaster. Now, with Hurricane Helene, it affected South Carolina a little differently. Most times it came off the coast, off the East Coast, and affected South Carolina. This time, it came up from Florida up the western side of South Carolina and kind of settled over the northern area. So it was a little different. So our practicing before with these other hurricanes was a little different with this hurricane.
I mean, you may have talked about this. This may have been what you were referring to, because last August it was reported that your office planned to spend more than $150 million in federal funding to support long-term recovery efforts from that storm. That was last August. Is it normal for that kind of money to be appropriated so long after a storm?
Normally it's a year, 15 months afterwards before the money is received. And that's because Congress has to go through and allocate money for these disasters. And there were so many disasters, till it took them a while to allocate the money for these disasters. I think it was like 8 or 10 disasters that they had to fund through that one legislation.
This disaster in Western North Carolina, at least, it's almost unimaginable. And the General Assembly has passed three major funding bills. One, I think, is lost somewhere, but three have been passed, and it amounts to about $1.5 billion. And now Governor Stein, wants $800 million more. How much of that money has gotten to where it needs to go, Gerard?
Keep asking me these difficult, complex questions, and we only have a couple minutes.
I'll take your time.
The state has been quick, and they do a good job explaining how quick they have been in setting up programs, in propping up programs, especially, we've talked a lot about how different this storm looks and how different recovery looks because it's on the west coast, on the west coast of the state, in the mountains and not in the kind of coastal flatland. I can give examples of how the state has been moving money faster because they're just more able to. They don't have the same level of bureaucracy as FEMA does on the federal side. They do have a level of bureaucracy, and they have to, you know, make sure they're being good stewards of taxpayer money. But one interesting thing that they've done is realize that in some cases, we're not going to be as fast as nonprofits. So let's take this money, and instead of propping up a program and paying the administrative cost of that program and paying state staff to do things, let's give this chunk of money to nonprofits that we've worked with before who are already doing this work, who are more agile, more nimble with how they can spend their money. And they've distributed millions of dollars to nonprofits who are able to, in conjunction with state, work on things like home repair. You know, in the winter, I visited a lot of homes, a lot of RVs where people are living because their homes are destroyed or so damaged that they can't live inside. And nonprofits that were propped up by state money were able to go in and what they call winterize these campers, basically insulate them and not have them freezing.
Chris, you're one of those nonprofits. How much money have they funneled into your efforts, and how much money have you spent, and where is it going?
Well, let's see. I'd say we've received about $10 million for our debris cleanup team. Mm-hmm. There's some negotiations now for additional funding for septic repair. But the bulk of the money that's coming from the state, and a lot of that is HUD money that's coming through the Department of Commerce, about $1.4 billion, a significant chunk of that has been held back as the state, in many ways, they have to let FEMA claims get resolved first because this HUD money is funding of last resort. So if you have put in a FEMA application, you can't access this HUD money until that FEMA claim has been resolved. And with the government shutdown and with DOGE really constricting some of our federal agencies, that's been a slow process.
And he didn't mention Gerard Christie Noem, who also slowed things down. She's the former head of that department, the Homeland Security Director. She had a requirement that she personally approve spending over $100,000. Well, this is well over $100,000, and it's a lot of spending for a lot of different things. The new head of that department, Mark Wayne Mullen, was, I think, in Chimney Rock last week before last. He says he's removing that requirement. Is it too soon to say that things are moving faster at FEMA because of his presence there?
FEMA, because of that $100,000 policy, created a massive backlog, not just in Western North Carolina, but to disasters around the country. I think it was the New York Times that reported that it was about $17 billion of a backlog in disaster funds. Now that that rule is not there, Mark Wayne Mullen is working to expedite that backlog. The feds have allocated, I think it's about $7 billion to Western North Carolina. Governor Stein has a request out for another $13 billion, but we haven't even gotten through that $7 billion. We haven't gotten that money yet, in part because of this backlog. From the disaster recovery officials in the state, politicians on both sides of the aisle, things are moving a bit quicker. Obviously, Mark Wayne Mullen has been in office about 3 weeks, mm-hmm. yet to be seen, but he does say he intends to clear that backlog.
So, Benjamin, one of the reasons they created your office, the South Carolina Office of Resilience, was because you had a lot of different entities in the state that had to come together for disaster relief. And your office now is the central point for all of it. It's not going here and there and everywhere to get money and relief work done. Have you experienced, however, the same kind of red tape and bureaucracy getting money or help from the federal level that we are experiencing in North Carolina? And what has that done to your ability to either build back or to build for the future and be more resilient about it?
Well, in South Carolina, with federal government is always slow. It's just the process. And most people say it's because of accountability is why the process is slow. In South Carolina, we have been the flagship for disaster recovery. And in the way we spend our money efficiently and effectively, HUD sent Maui Remember all the homes that burned down in Hawaii?
Hawaii.
They sent Maui to us for a week so that we can teach them how we get it done so efficiently. So normally we don't have a problem with HUD and getting the money and getting it to our citizens or spending the money the way we should with our home repair and replacement program and the other programs that we have. With that $150 million you talked about, $20 million of that goes into stormwater infrastructure, meaning stormwater drainage, flood mitigation. So we're working on that now. We have not done anything with flood mitigation yet, but we are started on the home repair and replacement programs for our citizens. And again, we lead the nation with that.
So we talked a lot about what has happened because of Helene and the need to continue the recovery, which will go on for years now. We haven't talked yet about being resilient for the future, and because climate change is a factor of life, because it's going to cause stronger storms, more wetter storms, more fires in brush areas like the mountains, we should talk about that. Chris, your organization, Mountain True, launched the Appalachian Design Center to help communities rebuild stronger. I'm just curious what that means. How do you rebuild stronger in the face of Mother Nature?
Well, that's fortunately not my job to figure out. It is the job of the volunteer designers that give their time to the communities across Western North Carolina that established what was originally the Asheville Design Center, established back in 2006. I've been heading it up for almost 20 years now. We merged with Mountain True in 2017. And as the Appalachian Design Center, really to focus on more rural areas that have the least capacity, fewest resources, we are sending design teams out to those communities to better understand from the experts themselves, the people that live there, how their area was impacted by the storm, and then how to best prepare for something similar to that in the future. So that might mean relocating businesses out of the floodplain. That might mean establishing steep slope regulations in some counties that have not had zoning ever. And sometimes it can be an uphill battle, but I feel like the lessons of Helene are pretty fresh in our memories. We talk about flood amnesia. It happened in Nashville after 2004. We had severe flooding in our River Arts District, but by 2007, 2008, we weren't talking about flooding anymore. And we were talking about establishing our River Arts District. So with the lessons fresh in our memories, we feel like we've got an opportunity to really learn from the community how to be able to build back better and to be able to have a more resilient community.
There are people waiting in trailers, as Gerard pointed out, because they can't get the money yet to build back, and we don't need to talk about that anymore. We've already talked about it. But these people are waiting, and they've also, many of them, lived there their entire lives. Mm-hmm. They don't want to live anywhere else. Yep. The mountain lifestyle is what speaks to them. So what do you say to them? If you're somebody who lives up a steep mountain stretch with a road that has a tree across it and the bridge is washed out, and you shouldn't be there because it's going to cost a fortune to build it back, or you live in a floodplain and you shouldn't be living there either, and you want to move them out, what's the resistance factor been like?
Oh, I think it's human nature that after the storm, people just wanted to return to normalcy.
They want to go home.
And in many ways, they just wanted to go back to what they knew. And if their home was in the floodplain, that's where they wanted to return. Now, there are design solutions to be able to create a safer environment for them. You can raise houses up on stilts, but what we didn't account for was the freight train cars coming down the river, acting as missiles, propane tanks, 18-wheelers that, as projectiles, were taking out buildings and structures left and right. And that's, I think, a learning experience. You know, you mentioned that, you know, we have topography in Western North Carolina. So not only do we get flooding, but we get velocity with it. And that's something that we have the experts on board to be able to assess what that might look like in the future and then to try and anticipate that.
Where was the epicenter of the damage in South Carolina from Helene, and what kind of resilience efforts are you applying to put it all back together again so it doesn't happen as badly next time? And there will be a next time, most likely.
Yeah, it was mostly in the northwestern part of South Carolina. And the resilience efforts we're putting in place home buyouts. If you're in an area that's repetitive flooding, we will buy that home out. And that's the best way to assure that that individual or that group of individuals in that neighborhood will not have that problem in the future. We are putting in infrastructure, home infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure projects, stormwater drainage projects, and we try to go green. That's the most effective. That's the best looking for green infrastructure projects to be placed. So we are doing that now, and we're trying to do it in a way that's be most effective.
But there, North and South Carolina are very similar in terms of people being. They like things the way they are. In many ways, that's why they're here. And you're asking them to change, and you're putting in regulations, which we'll talk about in the next segment, so that this doesn't happen as badly again the next time that it happens. And they don't like regulation. People in this part of the country don't like regulation. So how are you getting around that?
Well, this is voluntary. When I say home buyout is voluntary, we can't make anyone sell their home and move. But we do try to stress with them to understand that this could happen again. And when I say repetitive, they've seen it before. And some of them are really wanting to use the program to get out of harm's way. They don't like being flooded out every year. Even with some areas, it's a major storm, 3 and 4 times a year. So we're seeing it happen more on a voluntary basis.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit more about resiliency and how you get buy-in from people who would like to go back home, but you're telling them they really shouldn't. How that works and what kind of resistance you're getting both from governments and from, because we both have Republican governors, Republican governments for the most part. Right. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. We're WFAE's Charlotte Talks coming to you from the Carolinas Climate Summit at UNC Charlotte's DuBois Center. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from the DuBois Center, UNC Charlotte's uptown campus, for the Carolinas Climate Summit that WFAE sponsors every year. And we're here with three guests talking about resiliency, building back better in the face of a changing climate, with the Gerard Albert, who reports on recovery efforts and more for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Benjamin Duncan is with us. He's the Chief Resilience Officer for the State of South Carolina's Office of Resilience. And Chris Troyell is the Healthy Communities Director for Mountain True. Mountain True, as you said a few minutes ago, created this Appalachian Design Center, in part because cities like Asheville, cities like Charlotte, cities like Greenville, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, all have planning departments. But some of these smaller communities do not. So they're at a loss in terms of what to do next and what to do to build back in a way that things won't be as drastic next time. Is that where you come in? Is that what you've been doing?
Yes, that has been the conscious decision of the design center this time around. As I said, we worked for over a decade in Asheville, specifically around a highway project in the River Arts District. But this time around, we recognize that there are communities, there are counties that don't even have a county planner on staff anymore. And for those counties to be able to start planning for the future, they do require outside help.
Chris mentioned, Benjamin, that there are some areas in North Carolina that don't have any zoning restrictions. And I know from having lived there, that is the case in many places in South Carolina. As a person who's in charge of resilience and building back better and making things make sense, zoning is often required. So are you dealing with that? Are you dealing with pushback from that?
No, we're dealing with it. What we did about a year and a half ago, we created 7 positions, they're watershed coordinators, to work with the cities and counties in that watershed to help them with their comprehensive plans and with the individual plans that they need to be ready for these storms. Yeah. They help determine what infrastructure projects that are needed for that area. Now, funding is another area that we need to deal with, but we are dealing with what is needed for that area to help them to be more resilient. And funding is one that we're working with the legislature on.
Chris, if we had the kinds of plans in place and the kinds of thinking about resilience in place prior to Hurricane Helene, would the damage have been as drastic as it was?
I would say no if we had the funding to be able to implement it. And that is really the linchpin to all of this. We can plan until the cows come home, but if we don't have the funding to be able to see those projects through, then we won't be ready for the next storm.
And you're not the only one who knows that. Clearly, policymakers know that. Is there the political will to find that money?
I believe there is, and I think that it helps that we're working in a lot of these rural districts. You mentioned that we have a Republican government in North Carolina. Well, a lot of the districts that were hit the hardest have Republican representatives, so they're going to hear right. directly from their constituents about the help that they need, and I hope that they're receptive.
And the reason I mentioned that we have two Republican legislatures and we have a Republican governor in South Carolina or Democratic governor in North Carolina is that they generally don't like a lot of rules and regulations. They think government should get out of the way. So you're saying that these Republican representatives who are from your area have seen the light? Is that what you're saying?
I'd like to think that they have. And if they haven't, we'll certainly show them where that light is. But I think that there is the scale of the impact in our communities, it was $60 billion yeah. of loss that we've had. And we've received, I guess when you add up state and federal funding, philanthropic dollars, insurance, we've received about $15 billion now. So we were about a quarter of the way back. And that's just to restore what we lost. That's not to prepare for the next storm.
Of course, Republicans also like low taxes, and they don't like to waste money. But you have a lot of hurricanes and storms that come through South Carolina. Is that why they started this Office of Resilience? They had the foresight to start this Office of Resilience because in the long run, it will save them money?
I think we all understand what happens when there's a major storm or hurricane. The legislature understands it. The governor understands it. So they're working together with us to try to lessen the impact of these disasters when they hit South Carolina.
Yeah.
There's an academic theory that says advantages go to those who pay attention. Our legislature is paying attention. Our governor is paying attention. So they are all working together to lessen these impacts on our communities.
Gerard.
One thing I'll add with zoning that makes it so different. I'm from South Florida, which gets hit by storms constantly, but we're flat. Up here in the mountains, one of the most devastating, outside of flash flooding, one of the most devastating events were the landslides. There's been a lot of talk about slope regulations and landslide zones and these types of things, something that at least a few of the Republicans in our state legislature are concerned about, rightly so, hearing it from constituents, is that when you do this type of zoning, property value goes down for the people surrounding it, for the people that live, you know, near it or downhill from it, down the mountain from it. And property tax is something that the legislature is looking at this year, and that's a whole other can of worms that I won't get into. But they have to balance the economics of that local government, where some of the tax base was, I don't mean to exaggerate here, but wiped off the map. There is no more land where there was land. There is no more house where there was house. There is no more business where there was business. So it's a, like many things with recovery, kind of a push and pull in the legislature when it comes to zoning. More so, it gets a little more intricate than simply the, climate change is a bad word and we don't want to use it.
Asheville had a unique situation where they had their arts district completely wiped out because it was right along the banks of the river, which flooded for the first time in that to that extent in about 100 years. But it could happen again because the 100-year floods now seem to come every 5 years. Mm-hmm. What should you put in a floodplain? Are they going to build back the arts district in that area, or are they going to put it someplace else?
No, I believe it'll come back.
In that same place?
Absolutely.
Is that stupid?
I'm not one to pass judgment on that. I would say that there are, you know, certainly buildings that withstood what happened, and I think can be designed in such a way that you can say, like for artists, the really expensive equipment that they keep, like a kiln or for mm-hmm. glass blowing furnace or something like that. I think that they recognize the need to be able to pull that back and out of the floodplain. There actually is an effort now to create a new creative campus well above the flood line to be able to put just that kind of equipment, so that if you have galleries with your art pieces in the floodplain and you know a storm's coming, you can remove that quickly, but it's a lot harder to move a clay kiln out of out of your shop. So I think there can be some preparation for that. There's been 20 years, more than 20 years of investment in our River Arts District, and it's really hard for those people to walk away from that investment. So
if you put in, this is a question for both you and Benjamin, if you put in regulations that limit where you can rebuild, if you put in regulations that tell you how you can rebuild, whether you put the thing on stilts or build some way that's more resilient to flooding or whatever it may be, that's likely to push up the cost of rebuilding, correct? And are you getting any pushback on that from people who want to go back to where they came from? Benjamin, I'll start with you.
I'm not sure if they're putting too many regulations in place. HUD's putting some regulations in place. If you're in the flood zone and you have to repair or replace your home using the HUD dollars, you have to elevate the home. So those are some of the regulations they're putting in or rules that they're putting in. So it is happening some, but not to a great number of regulations for that.
Chris?
I think that there's a certain amount of government regulation that can address this, but I actually feel like the private insurance industry could be driving this as well, because if folks, I think we had maybe 1% of our population had flood insurance before the storm. I would assume that number is going to go up after Helene.
Well, isn't that where the rubber is going to hit the road? You're from Florida, and we all know if you can get insurance in Florida, it's really expensive, and it's pricing people out of staying there in many cases. Is this where the rubber will meet the road on climate change?
You have to, when you talk about flood insurance, talk also about the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, which is, like everything else in FEMA and federal regulations, complicated. There has been talks of kind of privatizing that government insurance policy, as there's been talks about, restructuring FEMA, but it gets expensive, and it has to deal with FEMA flood maps, which aren't always up to date. It has to deal with, how close you put things to the river and whether you build them higher or not. There's a whole whirlwind of complications, but insurance is one of those things that gets incredibly expensive.
And Chris, it occurred to me yesterday when I was thinking about this show that because of rising sea levels, we have seen homes along the North Carolina coast falling into the ocean. At the same time, we see these beach reclamation projects ongoing where, okay, we lose a little beach, but we'll bulldoze all the sand back onto the beach at the cost of millions of dollars, and we'll do it over and over and over again because beachfront property is expensive. So if I'm sitting in Asheville and my home has been wiped away and I need to rebuild and I want to rebuild it back where it was, why can't I? If they're rebuilding that beach while homes are falling into the ocean, why do I have to move?
Well, I guess that's a personal decision, although I think that
isn't that a policy decision too? Why can't they get money to do whatever has to be done I can put my house back where it was?
I think that's a public debate of, where we want to invest our tax dollars. I will say that in more rural areas, we're not seeing as much affluence on the banks of the river. We're actually seeing more mobile home parks and folks that site in those areas because they are affordable. And I think that's going to be changing too.
Gerard.
One of the things you have to contend with, just to bring it back to the topography of the area, is that there aren't a lot of other places to go. Mm. There are slopes that are too steep to build on. There are places that you can't get construction equipment. So when you think about the kind of tension of, I want to rebuild here, but it's going to flood again, there's not a whole lot of other land you can build on, which adds to the kind of discussion about it.
So when you're talking about resiliency and building back better and making sure that things may resist Mother Nature better than they did before, Benjamin, what are you suggesting to people?
For our stormwater drainage projects, we're putting in a 100-year vision, what it would be in 100 years, looking at data, looking at the amount of rainfall. So we are looking 50 to 100 years down the road, what it would look like. So we're putting in that level of drainage into our projects. One thing, and I don't want to change the subject here, but the one thing that the governor has done, he has invested $200 million in land conservation, meaning preserving our wetlands. As you know, wetlands hold the water, releases it slower, and it doesn't flood quite as fast. So we're looking at many measures, not just four or five, but as many measures as we can to find ways to be resilient. 1 acre of wetlands can hold 1 million gallons of water. So when we see development that they're bringing in dirt and filling in and building, that's harming us. And that's one thing that we're trying to get people to understand. And through the governor's conservation measures, we are purchasing as many wetlands as we can. And so far, we have purchased over 86,000 acres with about half that money.
A lot of times after natural disasters, Chris, a lot of people come in from outside and start helping and working and planning and saying what you should and shouldn't do. But I'm told that during the recovery efforts in Western North Carolina, local knowledge, people who really understood the topography, the nooks and crannies, et cetera, was very helpful in those recovery efforts. How helpful will that be going forward if you want to build back better and be more resilient? Will that knowledge, that local knowledge, play a major role?
Oh, I think it's essential. I think experience is the best teacher. And for a lot of folks, they'll be able to tell us, we may show up in a community and develop a solution, a design solution that we think might work, but they can tell us that creek actually is not going to be able to accommodate what you're talking about. And they know from firsthand experience. So that's why I talk about the community itself as being the expert base that we draw our knowledge from. And that ensures, I think, the best designs in the end.
The people in this room, I think, would acknowledge climate change. A lot of people don't. A lot of people are climate change deniers, and they think it'll all take care of itself over time. But we are seeing, undeniably, stronger, longer-lasting, wetter storms, which are all part of a changing climate. Flooding is becoming more frequent across Appalachia. It's no longer a question of whether flooding might occur. It's when flooding will occur. Has Helene and the recovery efforts and the vast expense of those recovery efforts, has that begun to change minds of policymakers in your mind, Benjamin, in South Carolina? Has it begun to change minds?
Yes, just the creation of the Resilience Office. They see it. They understand it. That they're starting to fund it. And we've seen it in our last budget cycle here. The legislature, if it passes the way it should, there'll be over $15 million in resilience dollars towards projects and looking at ways to reduce flooding in areas.
I have 15 seconds, Chris. What about here?
I'm going to say it varies from individual to individual.
Okay. Chris Joyelle, you get the last word. He's the Healthy Communities Director for Mountain True. He was here along with Benjamin Duncan, Chief Resilience Officer for the State of South Carolina's Office of Resilience, and Gerard Albert, the Western North Carolina Rural Communities Reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.